So my name is Matt Jackson. As the slide says, I'll be presenting a chapter I co-authored with Caitlin Guastafaro in the audience here, and we'd also like to thank our mentors and editors, Dr. Shin and Self Brown and John Lutzker. And the title is Use of Mobile Phones to Help Prevent Child Maltreatment. And you'll notice on the slides I actually said mHealth a lot. That's sort of misleading. mHealth can be mobile health in general. So I'll be speaking specifically to cell phones and how they're used in child maltreatment. Are you in space? Okay, good. I have no relationships to disclose. So just a quick overview. I'll cover a little bit about what comprises child maltreatment, who is at risk for victimization as well as perpetration. Talk a little bit about the digital divide, because that's a concern anytime you're dealing with technology and interventions and underserved populations. Cover a couple of interventions in mHealth and technology and child maltreatment and public health writ large. And then give you a couple of safe care examples, which is where we hail from at Georgia State. And then just cover a few limitations, benefits, and future directions of cell phone usage. So what is child maltreatment? Well, it's defined by the Department of Health and Human Services as any act of omission or commission that related to the physical, psychological, sexual, medical, or emotional needs of a child, resulting in the harm, potential for harm, or threat of harm by a parent or other caregiver. And I think at this point it's really important to draw your attention between the difference between an act of omission and an act of commission. And omission is neglect. It can be something as simple as forgetting to give your child an inhaler if they have asthma, or something as tragic as leaving your child in a car with the windows up when it's hot. And then commission is obviously what you're used to hearing when you think of child abuse and neglect is spanking too hard or, you know, whooping or anything like that. So, and this is really important because when you look at the cases of what comprises child maltreatment, for instance, in 2012 there were 3.4 million referrals to all of the child welfare services in the United States, which resulted in 700,000 roughly substantiated cases of child maltreatment. And you can see these are two different graphs. One on the left is from 2002, one on the right is from 2012. And you can see over that 10-year period that the numbers for the ratio between abuse and neglect pretty much stayed the same. So, and I don't know why I flipped them, but abuse, right here you have 25% of cases of abuse, which means there were 75% cases of neglect. And then in 2012, again, you had 75% cases of neglect versus 25. So it's a pretty consistent trend over time that the majority of these cases of child maltreatment consists of acts of neglect. So what are some of the risk factors for child maltreatment? Well, for the victims, it's children 2 years and younger. And this is important, too, because the younger a child is, the higher the risk they have of being maltreated, abused or neglected. Children with special needs are, in particularly, at higher risk of child maltreatment. For the perpetrator, it's kind of what you would expect: single parent, low educational attainment, and social unemployment and lower income are very important. And that's when I get to the digital divide, you'll see why that's really significant. The adverse outcomes for the child are the risky health behaviors, cognitive impairment, increased odds of acquiring chronic disease, early mortality. Don't look at that. And it's also very costly to the United States in terms of dollars. 1 year, they estimate that 1 year of child maltreatment results in $124 billion in costs for the lifetime of those children. So that's just 1 year. The referrals to the child welfare services in the United States, that's $4.5 billion a year. And that's really important and significant when you consider that 58% of those costs fall to the states. So, you know, you have struggling states, they have all these programs, that's really tough for them. So the outcomes are not only bad for the children, who of course, but when you're a policymaker like I am, you got to be able to sell this stuff. So it's really costly in so many ways to society and our government. So luckily, we've had quite a bit of success in child maltreatment interventions, behavioral parenting training interventions, and stuff like that. However, there are obstacles to these interventions. There's parental obstacles, and there's also programmatic. Some of the primary parental obstacles are poverty. You can imagine a person who can't, you know, manage to scrape by food doesn't have time to take part in some intervention that some guy from the university wants them to participate in. Lack of social support, again, that kind of ties into, okay, I have four kids, you're going to help me with this one kid, what do I do with my other three kids? So there's not many people to take care of their children. not many people encouraging them, more importantly, to even do this. So you get into social norms and what's expected. Lack of transportation. That's Safe Care has done some, gotten around that. We're a home visiting program, so yay. Co-occurring issues, drug use, and things like that. Some of the programmatic obstacles, which just are just referring to any intervention and any obstacle that that intervention might have that keeps them from having the parent complete the program. So some of those are retention. The wide range of retention rates for parenting programs, 30 to 80% at completion. So that just depends on the modality, who's doing it, and all that. Scheduling with transient populations. This is very tough even for home visitors, because if we're going out and the population we're dealing with isn't very stable in their housing and things like that, then it's really hard to schedule those. Lack of cultural empathy among trainers. You'd like to think we're in public health. That's not really an issue, but it can be. And really how that leads to the parent not completing is the customer or the participant isn't satisfied with the services they're getting. So you get someone that's coming into your house, you know, trying to tell you how to raise your children and all that, and they're not doing it right or being culturally sympathetic. That can lead to some issues. So really, you have these obstacles. What are you going to do about it? Well, enter technology. So if you're thinking, like we all do, I think when I first became interested in this subject, I thought, well, you know, how are you going to, you know, this person's already lower income. They have all these obstacles. The last thing they're going to want to do is take on this extra burden of learning X. Well, the good news is that this is all Pew data. The digital divide is shrinking. As of now, or 2012, 57% of millennials own a desktop. And a millennial is strictly defined as 18 to 34, which is perfect because the majority of child maltreatment perpetrators are 18 to 30 or 32, but that's the meat of the range. And that's a desktop. 95% of millennials own a cell phone. So that's good. 77% of individuals with an income of less than $30,000 a year own a cell phone. Again, tying back into that obstacle of poverty or lower income. So we have a way around that when 77% of those people are using cell phones. 40% of that 77% use the cell phone as their primary access point to the internet. So that, and that's really important. I'll talk about some limitations of that. But long story short, too late, you can see the trends are moving up. So that's good. That really speaks to a lot of hope for any intervention that wants to use technology, is that, and there still is a digital divide. I'm not trying to say there's not, but it is shrinking, and there is a lot of opportunity there for anyone wanting to use technology in public health. So just in public health writ large, how are some of the ways cell phones have been used in interventions? Well, generally it's text messaging or the short message services or anything like that, because you can imagine there are several benefits to this type of reinforcement. You can do burst text. You can send it out to a lot of people for very low cost, or you can send out very targeted to different individuals. So some good benefits to there. It helps you reach hard-to-reach populations. Again, we just saw 95% of people have cell phones. So reach some ways they've been used is vaccine reminders, appointment reminders, and these are just what they sound like. You're trying to run an intervention that encourages people to get vaccines, so you send them a text message. Get a vaccine. And both of these studies and the appointment reminders as well, and healthcare provision appointments are really tough to keep. People drop out. Both of these studies showed very marked increases in participation in both their programs when they included a text messaging component. So there's really a lot of good promise there. But text messaging is not the only modality. As we know, now we have smartphones with cameras and things like that. So the important thing is to make sure that the modality or the tech matches up with your population. So more specifically, cell phones in child maltreatment populations, the famous Brandy. This was a text for baby, National Intervention for Pregnant and Postpartum Women, and it was basically text messages that were sent to pregnant or women of infants who, and they had health messages, don't smoke around your baby, but they were there. Reminders to go to the doctor and things like that, and just meant to encourage the mothers in ways that would help develop help their child development. It was developed by the CDC. It's still in existence, and it's free, which is always good, and it's open access, so anybody can do it, and they're available in Spanish and English. So that's a very well-known cell phone intervention in child maltreatment populations. So, now to my favorite part, the safe care augmentation. So these are, I'm going to go over a couple of studies where we took extant safe care modules and then used cell phones in modifying them. So the first one is the planned activities training, which is part of the parent-child interaction module. And it comprises 5 to 7 in-home sessions. They generally last about an hour. And there's 10 skills that we really try and get the caregiver to become expert in throughout the duration of the module. The one I like the best is the one I always talk about, is establishing rules and consequences. So the notion is that you have a child, you're about to do a 10-minute planned activity. It can be a play activity, it can be a meal, or anything that you might do with that child on a daily basis. The idea is that you say, okay, we're going to do this in 2 minutes. If you do it well, then I'll give you a treat at the end. And this really helps the child establish the rules and consequences. And again, the idea for this is that they reach the mastery for these skills, of these skills, by the time we leave in 5 to 7 sessions. So then they hypothesize, though, that by adding a cell phone, that the family engagement in the program would increase. So not only would they participate, but they would become more engaged, things like that. And also they increased the communication between the parent and the home visitor. So now it wasn't just when the home visitor was there, they were able to send the parent reminders of how to implement rules and consequences, how to implement some of the other elements of the module. So they showed really good, this part of the study actually showed significant results in between the experimental control groups, and the parents actually demonstrated more skills. They had higher level. It's rated 0 to 100, 80% is considered proficient, 100% is considered expert, and more of the family, we saw a significant difference in the families that use CPAT, the cell phone enhanced module. They went on to do a 2013, I think it's still going on, randomized control trial, and that's showing promising results as well, and that you see very stark differences between the people using the planned activities training standard and then the CPAT. So they're showing better results. So that's an example of using the text messaging and the cell phones in that capacity. I'm so happy this is working. So, you see, smartphones think you're so great, can you do this? And it's just flipping. I think that's great. It wasn't working on my computer. So this was, eye safety was a smaller study. It was a multiple baseline across 3 families. But it used more of a smartphone capacity because what they did, was take the filming capacity of the smartphone and apply it to our safe care safety module. And the safe care safety module is meant to help parents go into any room and identify and eliminate any kind of hazards that might be there. So poisons are always the one I come to because I don't have kids, but every time I open my counter and I see the poison, the wasp control or whatever, and I'm thinking, man, if I had a kid, that'd be terrible. And eliminate those. So then what they did with the iPhone was they had the parents, when the home visitors weren't there, go into a room and film the room and then send it to the home visitor. So then the home visitor didn't have to be there to watch them. They could just send them the video and say, okay, yes, you did a good job. You eliminated the TV off the counter, because especially with flat screens, that's really easy to do. So again, this was a multiple baseline across 3 families and showed very dramatic reductions in hazards. And for this, they actually did a customer satisfaction survey at the end, because with tech, that's always going to be important. Again, it was what I was saying in the beginning. A lot of these people are under strain already, underserved populations. It's really hard for them just to get by, and you're handing them some new thing that's going to solve all their problems. So they did a customer satisfaction survey with this one, and it scored really high. And none of the parents really felt as if by giving them this tech, it was too much of a burden, and they actually enjoyed using it. So those are a couple of safe care augmentations. So here are just some benefits and limitations using cell phones in general. Spoke to one already. The additional tasks could be burdensome to populations. That's where the Pew, your formative research, is really going to come in handy, because if you go to study X and it's telling you that this population isn't using smartphones, the last thing you want to do is go hand them a touchscreen and things like that. So specific to the study, the eye safety study I just mentioned with the smartphones, issues of lighting and filming, and this is really going to, any kind of tech you're using, it's AV, that has audio or visual components that it's going to be needed to, or it's going to need, people are going to need to look at it after the fact, that's a big issue. So a lot of the parents in the rooms were dark. So it's really kind of hard for the home visitor to see if they were, you know, actually identifying and eliminating the hazards. Ethical questions. This is one thing that always comes to my mind. And I think your ethical question hinges on the fact is if what you're, the piece of tech you're using, are they going to need that later? So if you're coming into a population and you have a smartphone, is that smartphone necessary to continue that behavior once you're gone so that you're putting that burden on them now to get a cell phone? Or is it just a measurement technique? So I think that's the ethical issue there. Indigenous technologies, I believe this is a term that our mentor John Lutzker coined, which I love, and it goes, it speaks to what kind of technologies is the population you're studying using. So if you go, you got 95% of millennials using cell phones, and that's an indigenous technology. That person already has that tech, so you're not putting a burden on them. The benefits, cost savings, all of our home visitor programs that we do benefit greatly because we're able to increase our presence in the home. So that's a lot of cost, especially with gas. Home visitors aren't having to visit as often, things like that. Reach a program to participants. I'm involved with Dad's UK right now, and we're able to reason. That's not cell phones, that's what I said. Reason tablets. It's really cool. Anybody wants to talk about that later? But you can see there's a lot of reach of program to participants in any kind of this tech because it's mobile. It's a cell phone. Both of those studies I mentioned, as well as many more, have been showed improved retention rates. If you, like I said, this is a chapter we wrote for an encyclopedia, so we got a pretty good knowledge base of what's working and what's not in the field, and most show pretty, at least improved retention rates. Very few showed reductions in retention rates. And it's better, most of the studies we look at have showed better outcomes for participants, which is the name of the game, really. Anytime you want to do an intervention, you want to make it cost effective, so the legislators and the program people want to do it. But more importantly, you want the people participating in the study to come out better off. So future directions. I think there's tons of them, and you read the literature and you can find everybody wants to do. I think for us and safe care in general, it's again back to the indigenous population, indigenous technology, and making sure that what you're doing fits the population, because you don't want to be a burden and you don't want to burden them. So I think that's in the research. A lot of what we do, going back to Dad's UK, is looking at the technology and how it's a burden and how it can help and how we can modify each component to make it better. So you can just call me if you got any references. That's it. Thank you. Any questions? You're faster.
Have you, particularly with violence prevention, have you looked at the safety factors with the cell phones? Things like using some of the transient technologies, Instagram, things like that, because very often abusers will look through their partner's phones and look at phone logs, see what messages that have been sent, photos that have been sent. So in some cases, even though you won't have that documentation later, good point is you won't have that documentation later that could create greater harm for the owner of the phone.
Right, and I would think in an IPV study or anything related to that, that would be very important. I don't think for what we do mainly it's as much of a concern, but I could definitely see how in any sort of violence against women or IPV type scenario that would be, because you know nothing once it's on the internet or once it's digital. And we do, I mean, even in our studies, we make it a point to tell everyone that all this information is de-identified. So when we first visit a father, he does a survey on a computer, which is mobile health, which, of course, makes people nervous, and duly so, because now I'm in the system. But he's not in the system. We had de-identified. It's only related through us. So that's more, I think, with safe care and the type of work we do when it comes to the word getting out. What we're worried about is we don't want, because safe care is often prescribed to people who have been through the system, so there's some stigma there, so we really try and calm their fears about that. So thanks, you.
Mm-hmm.
The texts were primarily reminder texts, but they were using the cell phones to enhance verbal communication. So the participant did have an open line to the home visitor. So that's a good question, because it does. But the text messaging was, if I'm remembering correctly, were specifically reminders about the. No, it was a pretty strict regimen. I mean, once a day, and then if they didn't hear from the participant, they would call. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is. It's interesting. Pew did a really good study, and they didn't update it in 14, but in 2012, they had it by generation. So, yeah, if you see, you know, when you look at certain age groups, you know, the younger kids are just coming up with it, so it's not a big deal to them. And so elder populations are much more reluctant to even take it on. But, yeah, there's definitely a generation gap there, and that really ties back into know your population. Formative research. Don't just go, oh, cell phones are cool, because the people that you're working with might not think that. My mom being one of them. I think that's mechanism dependent. So if we were there with safe care and we were prescribed by DFACS or whomever, then yeah, that becomes an issue. But as a research project, that's not, of course, if it's violence or abuse, then yeah, that's an issue. But so that would be. Yeah, I mean, we still have to, even at our level, you know, where we're not necessarily mandated by the state to do it, we still make sure they understand the risk that we're taking your information, it's de-identified, but we have to, by RIB ethical standards, let them know that there is a risk. So I would imagine if we move into the state, and Kate's actually done some work with. I like that argument. I don't want to be in that position.
You might have
cilantro. Seriously, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. It's just sugar.